I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more compelling and moving books you'll read is the memoir from Wahb Kanu, The Reason You Walk. The book chronicles a year or so that Wahb takes off from the CBC to spend time with his ailing father. I'll get Mr. Kanu to tell us about his father, their relationship, and how they got closer in the year or so before his father's death. The book also revisits his own childhood, but also the childhood his father had in a residential school. Wahb describes the conditions in which his father lived and the abuse he suffered. The book thoughtfully looks at his father's spiritualism and the relationship between Indigenous culture and Catholicism, especially how they both intersected in his father's life. Forgiveness, healing, and hope are themes throughout the book, whether it's Wahb's own journey or his father's. Wahb Kanu is the Associate Vice President for Indigenous Relations at the University of Winnipeg. He is also a correspondent with Al Jazeera America. He hosts CBC's Canada Read series, as well as hosted the acclaimed documentary series Eighth Fire. He's won awards for his hip-hop as well as his journalism. He is an honorary witness for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. He lives in Winnipeg, but joined me last week in Vancouver while in town for appearances at the Vancouver Writers' Fest. The website for more is at wahbkanu.ca. The book is published by Viking. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Wahb Kanu. Mr. Kanu, good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. What was the nature of your relationship with your father just before his diagnosis in 2012?
Well, you know, the nature of the relationship between he and I was that it was improving. Like, we were in the process of becoming close after an upbringing in which that wasn't always the case. You know, he went to residential school when he was a boy, and so his whole idea of how an adult should relate to a child was formed by how his childhood went with the priests and nuns. So he brought a lot of that home with him.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he was a great great person to be around too, like very strong in the language and culture, and showed me that, you know, our people have a rich intellectual tradition and there's a lot to be proud of as well. So, you know, we were at once, distant, and we had a lot of our relationship colored by his anger and his earlier trauma, but at the same time, there was a lot of positive there, too. And when he was diagnosed with cancer, you know, my sister and I, my younger sister, Shawan, and I, we just got on the phone and we just asked one another, you know, 10 years, 20 years from now, are we going to care whether or not we worked this summer or whether we were at school this summer, or are we going to care whether or not we took the time to make things right with the old man and get over any of the regrets and things that have been left unsaid in the past? So, you know, with that in mind, we just kind of resolved, well, let's put our lives on hold, come back, rally around the old man, help him reach the end of his life with dignity, and repair the relationships. But I guess the story of the book is that, you know, even though we went to kind of fix our relationship and make things right with him and to help him, he ended up also showing us a very, you know, powerful journey of reconciliation, you know, that he went on in that year as well.
He comes across in the book as just a brilliant guy with vast interests, really,
yeah.
just a great intellect. And
yeah.
So what I found particularly moving was this time that you all spent with him as he was dying. What was just, you know, not only the knowledge, but as you said, the lessons of reconciliation and how important that was. For a guy to go from being abused at a residential school to being a leader in his community to being a leader in this country, and then having the dignity and the ability to forgive, that's a hell of a journey.
Absolutely. And he showed us that, you know, that reconciliation doesn't have to just be this symbolic or ideological thing. It can be a very practical, tangible thing as well. And so I think the clearest iteration of that was, in April of 2012, he adopted the Archbishop of Winnipeg as his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And that was done in a traditional ceremony. So not only did he bring the Archbishop into our family, he also brought the Archbishop into our spirituality and into our traditional ways. And, you know, just in that one act, you know, achieved this kind of multifaceted very real form of reconciliation in which we were now connected to each other, an indigenous and a non-indigenous family, connected as kin, but also that our different faiths and different spiritualities could be brought closer together and in dialogue with one another, and that it was not something, you know, that was just symbolic, that it was something real, something practical. And so that was a remarkable moment in and of itself. And then, like, writing the book, what I realized on an even deeper level, or what resonated on a deeper level, was that, you know, he was also showing us an important lesson in human nature, you know, mm-hmm. that we have to rise above our initial, you know, perhaps negative reactions to when we are done wrong, and we have to embrace that true nature of our humanity, which is the good side, you know, the side free from pain and trauma, the side that's all about love and kindness and compassion. And so there's so many, you know, different levels of, you know, insight and teaching that were, I think, displayed to us in that year.
There's a scene in the book where, I guess his grandson, Derek, can't really understand this relationship that your father has with the Catholic Church. And he says something to Derek it's so simple, but at the end of the day, it's so profound and so powerful in terms of how he was able to reconcile the past with moving forward and forgiveness.
Yeah. You know, he basically just told my nephew, his grandson, you know, I don't have the luxury of time. I don't have the luxury of youth. I can't wait for the church and for non-Indigenous people to come and make things right. I have to go make things right, not for them, but I have to go make things right for me. Because I want to live the rest of my days happily, and I want to live the rest of my days free from this negativity that's been tormenting me all these years. And so that was his rationale, and, you know, when he explained it like that, you know, how can you argue against what he was doing? And even if we take that insight and remove it just from the Indigenous context, though I think that does have a lot to show us about what reconciliation can look like between Indigenous people and the rest of the country, mm-hmm. it's also a powerful lesson on just reconciliation between any two human beings or any peoples around the world, right? You know, mm-hmm. We often hang on to the fact that we are right. You know, that other person did me wrong. It's up to them to come back and make things right. We often hang on to that notion of righteousness, of rightness. And I guess what I've understood in reflecting on my father's words and lived experience is that, you know, it's not enough to be right. We also have to be good. And if we can put those two things together, you know, that we can be on the right side of history, but also through our actions embody the goodness that is a universal trait amongst the truest representation of our human nature, then I think that that's when we can really start to live up to our full potential and be the type of people that we want to be.
Now, you and I are the same age. You're just about a month or a couple months older than I am. And
right.
What I found fascinating in this book is this journey that you yourself have been on. You've had a rather eventful life already.
Yeah.
It puts people like me to shame, but nonetheless, there's a wonderful scene in the book where I guess you'd gone to jail, you'd spent time in jail, and so you were back at your folks' house, and you and your mom are walking the dog, and she says to you, "What happened to you?" When was that?
That would have been about 12, 13 years ago.
Yeah, and so what had happened in your life?
Well, I was basically caught up in the party lifestyle. So, you know, going out, like I was in university at the time, but going out and partying a lot on weekends and, you know, getting into fights and all the other kind of trouble and bad news that comes along with that sort of scene. And so, so I did get arrested a few times, you know, once for drinking and driving. Another time after getting into a street fight, you know, kind of got picked up after that. And then, you know, a few other run-ins with the law, like more like just, you know, breach of probation, mm-hmm. whatnot. So it's basically, you know, me just telling lies to myself that, you know, because I'd been done wrong as a child and, you know, experiencing racism in this country, you know, terrible racism, not just from other kids, but from adults, mm-hmm. you know, or that, you know, how my people were treated, that in some way I deserve to be able to live it up and be, you know, self-centered and, you know, a jerk, basically. So in that moment, like, it was just a moment of truth-telling, and it just kind of cut through the facade and, you know, the exterior, you know, image of myself that I had built up that was based on these inner kind of lies that I was telling myself. You know, my mom's words cut through that and just resonated with me, and I was like, yeah, you know what, you're right, I was raised better than this. I do have the benefit of a strong family and a good community around me, and I should change things for the better. And I guess, you know, my parents had done a good enough job of, you know, giving me some moral and ethical code that, you know, that did resonate somewhere inside of me and motivate me to start doing well. And so now, you know, a decade and change later, 12, 13 years later, like, as I'm reflecting on my father's example and that lesson of, you know, you don't just have to be right, you also have to be good. You know, that's something that I'm still trying to put into practice in my own life. And I've come a long way, but even after the hard work of examining my heart and character to make myself a more positive person, somebody who is a good influence on the community that I'm a part of, I know that there's still work left to do, right? Like, I still have to, you know, examine and interrogate, you know, my own feelings of anger or my own feelings of frustration and the negativity that I sometimes resort to too easily. So that was important for me to share. I wanted to be disclosive of that and, you know, show that also I've had my own journeys. And part of it is to illustrate the intergenerational impact of residential schools.
Yeah.
But part of it is also because I want to show young people, whether they're from my own community or from another community, that, you know, it's never too late to turn your life around. If you want to stop telling yourself the lies, and if you want to start getting closer to the truth of what your potential is and what you can do, once you start embracing your good nature and the better side of your humanity, I want to let people know that that's a journey that I've gone through and continue to go through, and that, you know, I wish them all the best if they set out on doing something similar.
See, it's one thing to improve oneself, to quit drinking and to not abuse oneself. But in your case, you've done that, you're working on that, and at the same time, you're wanting to help others. You're wanting to get the message out. You're being the activist in your community, in this country. How important is that aspect of service to you today?
Oh, it's huge. You know, I feel like there's a debt that I owe to my my community, to my family, but also to my country. You know, I know full well how much opportunity that I've had growing up in this part of the world, but also growing up in my family and in my culture. And so I want to do what I can to help all of those different dimensions of community reach their full potential. I want to help Indigenous people be able to succeed and be healthy and positive. And I want to help my country reach that vision that it sets for itself as being a pluralistic, multicultural society that's strong because it accommodates difference and diversity. And I want to tell the truth about where we're at and the fact that we're not perfect, but I also want to tell the truth about the fact that we're good and we get a lot of things right. And now let's have that conversation and let me be part of that dialogue of how we can close that gap, make things better for everybody, and help us all achieve what we know we can be in our hearts.
Yeah, well, what I think makes this book necessary reading is this idea that it starts a conversation that we all need to have in this culture, in this discourse, about the relationship that we have with one another. And I guess that's one of the things, other than, say, the catharsis you got out of writing it, that really fueled the writing of this book for you.
Yeah, I think so. You know, there was many things that motivated me. You know, part of it is about working through my own grief and losing my father. Part of it is to commemorate him and other residential school survivors and send a message to the rest of the country that they're not just emblems of pain and trauma. Many of their stories are some of the most powerful stories of inspiration that we can hear in these lands. But part of it is also that I just want to get at the universal core that I saw in my family that I think would resonate with a lot of other people. And it is this constant quest to try and get closer to the good and to get closer to the truth and to get closer to the better part of our human nature. And, you know, it's told through an indigenous lens, but I do hope that people see it as a story that's broader than just one for my community. And it's one that, you know, maybe people from many walks of life could hear about and use to, you know, maybe think about and help them out a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about the racism that you've encountered, it was nothing like that which your father encountered, but it's still, nonetheless, it's important to talk about that and bring that out, and so that people know that for a lot of people, it's still there in this country.
It is. And, you know, and I think my kids' experience is better than mine was when I was a boy.
Yeah.
So I'm realistic about things. Things are improving, right? There's no comparison between the, you know, reality that I faced growing up to the sort of oppression that my father and his generation experienced, right? So much worse. But just because, you know, we've improved against the benchmark of cultural genocide, you know, I don't think that's a standard that we want to judge ourselves by.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I think we want to judge ourselves by what are we capable of? What is, you know, the best possible society that we could build together, right? And that's what we should be looking towards. And so that is what I look towards and say, like, all right, so what can we do to make sure every kid in this country has an equal shot at life? You know, some of the basics we're still debating, you know, clean drinking water, education, stuff like that. Yeah, let's have that conversation. But let's also keep an eye on that longer-term conversation, which is how can we create a situation where indigenous people are able to contribute the wisdom and the knowledge of our cultures and nations to help the whole global society that we live in meet the challenges of our day, you know? And that's the future and the potential that I really get excited about, because, again, you know, returning to what we spoke about earlier, there is a tremendous intellectual capacity and perspicacity and, you know, tremendous levels of insight in indigenous nations. And I really want to live in a world where those, intellectual and cultural and spiritual insights are able to contribute to the overall good of everyone on this earth. And I think part of that would be facilitated by us all gaining a little bit of empathy and insight into one another's experience and understanding that apart from the cultural and, you know, visible differences between us, that at the end of the day, we're all just human beings flying through space on this giant rock. And we got to figure out a way to get together and get along, and would all be better for it.
Yeah, this year in your in your life that you talk about with your father's diagnosis, I mean, your career was just taking off. Also, Idle No More was happening.
That's right.
In terms of Idle No More, that did that have the sort of positive impact that you think it ought to have had with regards to how we all view each other, how indigenous cultures and say the rest of Canada, that we say continue?
Yeah, I think so. But it's important, I think, to see it as part of a journey, right? Not as, like, Idle No More was not the destination or the realization of reconciliation. It was another step forward, you know? And, like, look at the election that we just had in this country. Unprecedented participation and voter turnout on First Nations and from Indigenous people, and a record number of Indigenous MPs in the House of Commons. So to me, like, how what it looked like in the ground in my community is that people showed up in Idle No More 2012, 2013 to try and get rid of Harper through protest. That failed. But 2 years later, they showed up at the ballot box and voted as local candidates out of office. And, you know, and like in our riding, we're successful. Huge Indigenous turnout in the Kenora riding, and when a cabinet minister was turfed out.
Yeah.
So I think that all that to say that it's part of the progression, right? Idle No More helped this journey of visibility that I would say was begun by the residential school survivors. 1990, Phil Fontaine telling his story of abuse, right?
Yeah.
That helped clear the space. All the other survivor stories that came after that, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the apology, right? That cleared more space. Here we are 25 years later, and now Indigenous issues and Indigenous people have been on the rise in terms of visibility in the Canadian public sphere. We're not at the pinnacle of that yet. We're not at the realization of that journey yet. We still have a long way to go, but we're moving forward. We're making progress. This country is more inclusive, is better off for having undertaken this journey with us. And I remain hopeful that, you know, Idle No More, having played a big part in this journey, is just another step on the road, and we're going to see this movement pushing forward.
I understand that in interviews that you've done with regards to this book, you're asked this a lot as to where your life is headed in terms of service. The right. Speculation that you would go into politics. I mean, at this point, are you doing what you want, and what might that next progression be?
Well, I think, you know, federal politics are what interests me, and I'm very passionate about politics, but it's probably going to be at least 4 years before I get involved, given the fact we just had an election.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what I have planned next, you know, I want to write another book, and I also, I'm a big tech geek. Like, I love technology, and so I want to spend a bit of time in the technology world and, you know, try and pursue a few ideas there. But I definitely do think at some point in my life I will get engaged with the political sphere, whether that happens in 4 years or perhaps, you know, more in the 10, 15, 20-year timeline. I can't really say right now. But, yeah, probably someday in the future I'll get engaged with the political arena.
What has your family thought, namely your mom, thought of this book?
Well, it's been a mixed reaction from my family. The vast majority of people have been supportive and positive, but not everybody. My mom in particular has been nothing but supportive and encouraging. And, you know, even though she says, you know, if I would have written some of these stories, I would have written them a little differently.
Yeah.
Right? But that's because it's, we all see things through our own lens.
Uh-huh.
But even though she says that, she does still believe in the book and the work that I'm doing in promoting it.
The people that don't like the book within your family, I mean, what might they have objection to say?
I think it's a combination of not being a fan of me kind of putting our dirty laundry out there.
Right.
You know, so to speak,
yeah.
And then just, you know, our own, we're all working through our own stuff at our own pace, you know.
Yeah. The other thing that I've noticed when people talk about you, and as I said, we're the same age, and I kind of get annoyed, is that when they bring up your age, and they're
yeah.
amazed at just how wise you are. I mean, that gets
yeah.
annoying, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know about annoyed, but I mean, I definitely feel like somebody our age can have already experienced a lot and gained a lot of insight. And there's people younger than me
yeah.
that I'm amazed at how much they get it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's because they come from great families and they've traveled the world, right? Like, Craig Kielberger. Mm-hmm. Or other times it's because they came up through a very rough and tumble existence, and they were forced to be independent and figure life out at an early age, like some of the young people I work with in the university setting. So yeah, I'd hope that our society is one that becomes more humane in all directions, and, you know, at the same time that I'm saying let's have more respect for the elderly and the journey to the end of life, I'd also say, like, let's also recognize that young people have a lot, or I guess, you know, we may not be young anymore. Younger people have a lot to contribute as well, and that sometimes fresh blood, new ideas can count for a lot, you know?
You know, the title of the book, The Reason You Walk, when I first saw it several months ago, I thought, you know, that's a pretty good title. And then in the
yeah.
book, there are four meanings to this phrase, The Reason You Walk. And
yeah.
it makes reading the book all the more powerful, and that phrase itself all the more powerful.
Right.
The meaning of that is what? And for you, of the four, I guess, the four definitions of that, what
yeah.
resonates the most for you?
Well, I'm somewhere on that journey of understanding. You know, the words come from the text of a song that our people, the Anishinaabe people, use, the traveling song sung at the end of every gathering. And in that song, we're taught that it's the Creator speaking to us, saying, I am the reason you walk. And as we go through life, our understanding of what that means, it becomes deeper and more fully formed, right? So in the beginning, you know, we're kids. It's almost like our image of the Creator's message is drawn in crayons, kind of very simple. It's, I made you, therefore I'm the reason you walk. Then we go a little bit further, and our picture becomes a little clearer, and we understand it. Okay, I am the reason you walk because I'm the thing that that animates you. I am life. Then we go even further, and we get a more fully formed vision of what that means. And then it's, I'm the reason you walk. I am that force called love that forces you to do good and bring things back together after maybe some wrong has been committed. And then finally, at the end of your life, and you might understand it, is I'm the reason you walk. I'm the thing that you are now walking home towards, right? And I can't say that I fully understand all the dimensions of that teaching, but to me it did seem like a good way to encapsulate my father's journey from early trauma and dysfunction to later success and eventually realization of a fully free heart and mind and spirit that lived out its final days without inhibition and only displaying those universal values of goodness that I would say are what our ideas of the Creator or God or of a universal human ethic try to represent in our minds and in our thoughts.
Yeah, death fears a lot, scares a lot of people, but from what I read of your father, it's not something to fear, really.
I think part of our fear of death comes from the fact that we're maybe afraid that we won't get a chance to answer the big questions in our life, like, who am I?
Yeah.
Maybe we'll die before I actually figure out who I am. You know, am I just a guy named Wob, or am I a guy who writes books, or am I something more than that? Because I feel like there's more than that. And I think part of the fear also comes from, like, you know, what does it all mean? Am I going to figure out a satisfactory answer to that before, you know, the lights go out? And my answer to that is, you know, we just live our life, you know, and each moment we get a little closer, a little bit clearer understanding of what everything here might be about. And if we do our best to perfect ourselves, bearing in mind that we'll never be perfect, I think that we can get a little closer to those things, and we should feel okay with the fact that we're not going to be eternal, we're not going to be here forever, and maybe we're never going to have a complete answer to those big questions in life, but that there is a meaning and there is a value in the journey that might deliver you a little bit closer to those answers.
A lot of people have also talked about this book in terms of how you're of a second generation from a residential school survivor. Yet his story, your father's story, still very much affects your life, and I suspect it's your future generations as well, your own kids. I mean, this is their story too, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, that's an important part of it. You know, he raised me with a lot of anger and strict discipline, and, you know, very harsh. And what I recognized writing the book is, He was made to feel angry and powerless by the priests and nuns. And when I was growing up, I was made to feel angry and powerless by him, though obviously not as severe and not as drastic measures, you know, were used. But then as I was writing the book, I'm sitting there on a plane staring at my laptop, and I realized, holy cow, I'm making my sons feel the exact same way, more than I would like. And again, it's not as severe as my father was with me, and I'm not, you know, abusive to them in any way, but it's just that there is this part of my character which is a hangover from residential schools, this part of me that responds to stress with anger or responds to insolence with frustration or is too quick to make a little cutting remark that I know from my own experience can be very harmful to the self-esteem of a young person, right? And the fact that I still perpetuate those things in my own life, even though, like, by most measures, I'm a great dad, right? I'm helping to coach the hockey team, and, you know, I'm I'm there for them all the time and doing all these great things with them. The fact that I'm not the perfect, freest, you know, most cultivating of resiliency kind of dad that I believe that I can be tells me that there's work yet to do in my heart to escape the legacy of residential schools. So I do hope that, you know, I can do that work in my heart and in my character so that I can just be a positive influence on my kids and that they don't feel like they were negatively or adversely impacted by parenting. But obviously, you know, there's still a ways to go. You know, I'm not trying to, you know, and I understand people might listen to that and think like, oh, well, big deal, Wob. Like, everybody's dad's a little stoic or a little distant or a little harsh, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I'm not trying to use the example of the average to kind of assuage myself or, yeah. you know, reassure myself. I'm trying to use the example of what's possible and what's perfect as motivation for me to do better. And so when I look at my parenting, I think that that's the clearest way that the residential school legacy continues to impact us because, you know, we're not on the streets, you know, we're all successful for the most part professionally in my family, you know, we're not battling addiction anymore, things like that. But yet there still is this part of us that has been impacted and that we need to work on.
Wob, this is such a wonderful book. It's a powerful book. I could talk all day with you about it.
Yeah.
Congratulations on it, and thanks so much for this book and for this conversation today. I really appreciate it.
Well, miigwech, and thanks for taking the time.
You're very welcome. Wobcanoe.ca is the website. The Reason You Walk is the title of the book. It's published by Viking. Wob Canoe, its author, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.